Everyone ducked behind the protective railings as Beck took swift shore back up again, out of reach of the attack. As he did so, Treffen Maurice came running back. "There are rock trolls down there in that tower," he shouted up to Beck. "They were waving to us for help." Beck turned to Rue. "Load both the port and starboard rail slings. Maybe we can drive the Ordus far enough back into the trees to gain space to get a ladder down." The starboard rail sling was still in place from their flight out of Paranor, and with help from Treffen Maurice, it took Rue only minutes to set up the port weapon and arm them both. Placing the young druid on the former and herself on the latter, she sent Bellazin amidships to stand ready to lower the rope ladder, then signaled for Beck to take swift shore down again. It was trickier going in the second time. The Ordus were waiting, neither awed nor frightened of the airship. Even from high up, Beck could tell that they were aggressively hostile. Whatever had incensed them had stirred their anger to such intensity that they were beyond caring what happened to them so long as they stopped any rescue attempt. They were clustered at every quarter of the tower walls, and as soon as Swift Shore came within range, they attacked. Beck kept his hold on the airship steady to give Rue and Treffen Maurice a chance to chase them off, but even after both rail slings were emptied twice into the attackers, they held their ground, refusing to fall back. Gnarled, hairy forms swarmed through the wooded ravines, keeping the tower and its occupants besieged. Beck took the airship out of range once more, trying to think what else they might try. Rue returned from the railing and climbed into the pilot box. "Our weapons aren't going to work, Beck. If we want to get those rock trolls out of that tower, we have to take a different approach." She leaned close, so that only he could hear. "Could you use the wish song to help?" He stared at her in surprise. She hated his magic, hated the legacy that went with it, so much so that he had barely used it since coming back from Parcasia. The search for their son had marked his first serious attempt in several years. In truth, he wasn't even sure he knew after so long how to employ it in the way that would be necessary. "I understand," she said, reading the look on his face, "but we don't have any choice." She was saying that if they wanted to help Penn, this was what it was going to take. The wind shifted and blew across his face, unexpectedly chill and biting as it came down off the mountains. He held her gaze a moment longer, then nodded. "Take the helm." He went down on deck to where the young druids stood waiting and motioned them over to the rope ladder so that both could help with the rescue effort. Then he moved forward to the bow and looked down. Ordos swarmed through the trees below, too many to count. Rue was right. Even a dozen rail slings wouldn't be enough to chase them off. A more effective weapon was needed, and there was nothing more effective than the wish song when it was used in the right way. Grianne had taught him so years ago when she had tried to kill him. He thought it ironic that he would use that lesson now to try to save her. "Take us back down," he shouted to Rue, a sudden gust of wind nearly obscuring his words. It was heavy enough that it shook the airship from bow to stern. "Slowly." He glanced north, to where huge storm clouds were beginning to build on the horizon, sifting down through the peaks toward the Incrim. A change in the weather was coming, and it did not favor their efforts. If they failed to get a ladder down soon, given the nature of storms in that region, it might not be possible to try again for days. He looked down at the Ordus, trying to think how to force them to move back from the walls of the tower. He could do some things safely with the wish song, but he did not want to risk trying too much after so many years of no practice. The magic was powerful and, at times, unpredictable. Using it the wrong way could prove disastrous. If it failed to respond as intended, it might send them all crashing down with the airship. The wind gusted across his face again, and suddenly he remembered that the druids favored using the elements as allies in their wielding of magic. Perhaps he could do the same here. He brought up the wish song in a soft hum, calling it to life, feeling it come awake and then flood through him with a slow, rising heat. He kept his gaze fixed on the scene below as he began to give the magic a shape and a form, a sense and a purpose. He found the wind currents that preceded the coming storm and stirred in the magic. The currents gained force and consistency, and as they gusted about him, they began to take on a new intensity. What had begun as a series of uneven bursts now became a steady blow. Changes of pitch evened and slowly built into a howl that suggested the cresting of a tidal wave. The Urdas began looking around in confusion and then in fear. A storm of that kind wasn't something they understood. They were unfamiliar with winds of such magnitude. They crouched lower and then began to back away from the tower toward the deep woods, their superstitious nature warning them that the elements were spirit-driven. Beck built on the power of his magic, adding fresh layers, giving the wind an extraordinary sound and feel, a roar that began to shake trees and earth alike. He did not look back at Rue, trusting her to continue Swiftsure's descent, to understand what he was doing and not be frightened by it. He didn't know what the druids were thinking, but he couldn't spare time to worry about them. He had the wind tearing across the landscape by then, scattering the Urdas in all directions, their determination to stand fast shattered. Then the treetops were right below them, and the outer walls of the tower became visible through the gaps. He risked a quick glance back at Trefin Maurice and Bellazan and saw them dropping the rope ladder over the side of the railing down to the besieged trolls. Almost immediately, bulky forms began to emerge, scrambling from their concealment, some helping others, all of them moving swiftly for the ladder. But then they ducked back again, unable to advance. Beck felt his strength beginning to fail and forced himself to push harder to keep the wind in place. The trolls had still not begun to climb the ladder, and the Urdas were beginning to re-emerge from the trees. Rue was yelling something at him, but he couldn't hear what. He intensified the magic once more, feeling his hold on it slipping away. Then, Bellazan was beside him, frantic. "Your magic is too strong, Beck. The force of the wind is keeping the trolls from climbing the ladder." He realized it was true, that his efforts at keeping the Urdas at bay were keeping the trolls pinned down as well. Rue must have been trying to tell him as much. He slowed his efforts, letting the wind diminish. Within the ruins of the tower, the trolls recognized their opportunity and scrambled for the ladder. The Urdas, in response, rushed to stop them. There was nothing more Beck could do to help. Any further use of the magic to intensify the wind would do as much damage as good. The trolls would have to make it on their own. He kept the wind in place a few moments longer, turning its sound to an ear-splitting shriek in an effort to frighten the Urdas. But the Incrim natives were no longer intimidated, having seen what was happening, and become newly enraged at the thought of losing the intruders to an airship rescue. They came at the trolls in waves, weapons loosing, the air filling with missiles. Two of the trolls were struck, and one fell to his death. The others pressed on, climbing steadily through the hail of fire, helping each other as they did so. One of them, he saw, carried a smaller figure tucked under one arm, a squat, blocky form that could only be a dwarf. Then the trolls were over the side of the railing and on board the ship, and Rue was lifting away, taking them quickly out of range of their attackers. Beck broke off his efforts with the wish song, now thoroughly spent, and hurried over to the newcomers, seven trolls and a dwarf he saw. The dwarf wrestled free of the troll who was carrying him and stood clinging to the rail, breathing hard. "Tagwin?" Beck asked, coming up to him. Tagwin looked over, his face ashen and his mouth a tight line. There was blood on his neck and right arm from wounds, and his clothing was torn and soiled. He blinked rapidly at Beck.
I don't ever want to come to this place again, he snapped. Not ever.
Then he fainted. There was no time for an exchange of information or for anything but making a quick escape from the fast-approaching storm. If it caught up with them over the Increm, their efforts to get free of the Ordos might come to nothing. With Beck at the helm, Rue and Treffen Maurice worked the draws and light sheaths by hand to gain speed and maneuverability, heading south and west toward the relative safety of the mountain peaks below the clouds and winds building north. Swiftsure skated hard across the long stretch of the valley, buffeted and tossed as storm winds gusted ahead of rain and dark skies. Lightning began to flash in the heart of the encroaching dark, and thunder rumbled ominously across the heavens in long, crackling peals. On the decks below the pilot house, Bellizen worked on the injured rock trolls. Two of them were badly hurt, wounded by Urda weapons. According to Kermadec, who had managed to say a few words to Beck before Swiftsure set sail, his little company had tried to slip past the Ordos during the night, convinced that any attempt at fighting to get free was useless. By then, Penn had been gone for almost a day, and they were desperate to find a way to help him. But the Ordos, furious at what they perceived to be a deliberate violation of sacred ground, had been keeping close watch on the intruders and had no intention of letting them escape. They reacted swiftly to the attempt, catching them out in the open and killing two outright. The surviving trolls and Tagwin had fled into the tower, where they had remained trapped and under attack. Rain struck Swiftsure a broadside blow that sent her scudding sideways across the roof of the forest. Beck righted her quickly, trying not to think about Penn and what had happened in the ruins days earlier, concentrating instead on getting them across the valley to the relative safety of the mountains. Inside the peaks, they could find protection from the storm and cross into the valleys beyond. But the rain descended in torrents, inundating the decks and those clustered on them, leaving the entire ship sodden and dripping. Visibility was dropping fast, and Beck turned the ship farther south in an effort to run before the storm and remain clear of its impenetrable shroud of rain and mist. Then, lightning struck the mainmast, dancing down its length and along the conductors to the hull, sparking and flashing in the near dark. The trolls flattened themselves against the deck until Bellizen signaled for help to get the injured below. Staggering across the slick wood with their burdens, the trolls did as she asked, and soon everyone had disappeared below, leaving Beck, Rue, and Treffen Maurice to sail the airship. They were flying dangerously low, trying to slip the stronger winds at the higher elevations. But radiant draws, stays, and sails were all giving way, tearing loose or shredding, slowly eroding Swiftsure's maneuverability. Beck held the airship as steady as he could, relying on the power stored in the diapson crystals to keep her flying. When that was gone, they were finished. He could make out gaps in the mountain peaks ahead, dark passages to the valleys beyond, and he pointed toward them as the storm closed about. The winds howled like a living thing. They slammed into Swiftsure with devastating impact, knocking her off course, forcing Beck to wrestle her back into line again. Rain descended in sheets, and visibility dropped to nothing. Even the dark gaps for which they were headed began to fade. The storm was sweeping the whole of the Increm now, a great, roiling mass of wind, rain, and darkness. Then, abruptly, the mountains ahead disappeared, and the gaps toward which Swiftsure had been heading were gone. We're not going to make it, Beck thought. For heart-stopping minutes, they hung suspended in a gray, fathomless void, directionless, and lost. Then, the curtain of rain lifted, and the rock walls loomed out of the rain-soaked darkness once more, massive slabs of stone lifting thousands of feet into the mists. Beck caught sight of a gap between them and banked Swiftsure sharply toward its dark maw. Seconds later, they were inside a craggy split that was as dark and still and windless as a subterranean passage.
Savages!
Atalan spit the word out as if to rid himself of its bitter taste. It was a word he had used 3 times in the last 2 sentences by Beck's reckoning. Apparently, the bitterness had a tendency to linger.
Killed 4 of us for no better reason than to punish us for coming into those ruins. A place of dead things. Nothing there but bones and rubble and monsters like that tree.
His blunt troll features were unreadable, but his eyes were fierce.
We should come back here with the rest of our people and wipe them out.
He was incensed, even now, hours later. They were seated at the bow, Atalan, Kermadec, Tagwin, the young druids, Rue, and Beck. They made an odd-looking group. The trolls were giants with skins of bark and flat, virtually featureless faces. The druids were much smaller and impossibly young. The dwarf was squat and solid, his thick beard like a mask, and Beck and Rue, fatigued and weak from the wounds they had received during their flight out of Paranor, had the look of the walking dead. Swiftsure hung anchored above a valley floor somewhere deep within the Clue, west almost to the Charnels. The Incrim and the storm had been left behind. It was nightfall, and the trolls who had been wounded were sleeping below. Everyone was exhausted. Kermadec shifted his large frame and leaned back against the ship's railing. His rough face was impassive, his voice calm.
Let it be, Atalan.
He nodded at Beck and Rue.
So, young Pendaren has found a way into the Forbidding after all. Your son is nothing if not resourceful. He has kept his wits about him.
He has his wits. But does he have the use of magic as well? Rue asked, reminded suddenly of what Beck had revealed of the traces of her son's passage. Kermadec shrugged.
He has some. He has that ability to read the responses of living things. He can discern their thinking from that. Like the lichen, like that moorcat.
He glanced at Tagwin.
It's a magic I wouldn't mind having, Bristlebeard. He said it was a small magic, the dwarf muttered.
He scowled at Kermadec.
Having seen nothing to suggest otherwise, I am inclined to take him at his word. Pendaren is not given to exaggeration.
Tagwin had recovered from his faint, though he was still embarrassed about the collapse. Kermadec had spent a long time reassuring the dwarf that it had nothing to do with his courage, but was a result of exhaustion and stress. Anyone might have suffered the same indignity, and it would not be mentioned again. Tagwin, however, did not appear convinced.
There is the magic he generated during his encounter with the Tanaquil as well,
Treffen Maurice pointed out.
To create a talisman of such power, a tremendous amount of magic would have to be released. Even if it didn't come from Pen, traces of it would cling to him. And he carries the dark wand with him. Any reading of magic attached to Pen would be influenced by that.
It was a reasonable explanation, and even Rue seemed to accept it. Only Beck knew that the reasoning was wrong. The readings given him by the wish song had told him that the traces of his son's passage encompassed only magic that belonged to him. The blood connection between father and son was too strong for him to be mistaken. Pen had uncovered a form of magic that was still a mystery, possibly even to himself. I'm very sorry to hear that Arryn Elessadil is dead, he said to Tagwin, changing the subject. The dwarf looked down at his hands and shook his shaggy head slowly.
He was a brave man, Beck Olmsford. He gave his life so that the rest of us could go on. We would not have reached Kermadec and Taupo Ruff, let alone Stridegate and the Tanaquil, if not for him.
And the elven girl is his niece?
Kyber Elessadil. Tough as old leather, that girl. though nearly as young as Pandaren. She has the elf stones, took them from the Elessidils and brought them to Arryn so that he would teach her how to use them. Turned out he had no choice. She used them in the slags to sink the Gallifile, then, again later, to help us on our journey here. She had them with her when she disappeared in Stridegate.
But you think that she boarded one of the druid airships that took Penn to Paranor? Rue asked.
Tagwin looked at Kermadec and came to some unspoken agreement.
Something might have happened to her in the ruins after she left us and went in search of Pandaren, but I don't think so,
the dwarf declared. He looked up.
She was very close to the boy and determined to help him reach the Ard Ris. I think she found a way, and that's why he was able to get into the Forbidding after the druids took him prisoner. Well, the fact that the King of the Silver River told Beck in his dream that an elven girl is one of the three who will help us reach Penn suggests you are right. But where is she now? She must be at Paranor,
Kermadec answered with another shrug,
waiting for us.
Then we must go there to help them,
Tagwin declared firmly.
It was the promise I made to young Pandaren before they took him, and I intend to fulfill it. As do I,
Kermadec agreed. How exactly are you going to go about doing that? Belizen asked suddenly, starlight reflected in her ink-black eyes. Do you have a plan? Neither of them did, of course. No one did. There was a long silence as they pondered her question. They had been so consumed with reaching Paranor that none of them had given much thought to what they would do once they were there. It wasn't at all clear, they realized as they reflected on the possibilities, what their course of action should be.
What are we up against at Paranor? Beck asked finally, looking from Belizen to Trefin Maurice. How much support does my sister have?
Trefin Maurice shook his head.
Very little, I'm afraid. There are a handful of druids who openly support her and will stand with her when she returns, but most have been dismissed from the Order. Those who remain support Shadea. It isn't that they believe so strongly in her, it's more that they mistrust your sister. She has never been able to shed her image as the Ill's Witch, not entirely.
Some will stand with her when she returns, Belizen added, but only some, and I do not think we can count their numbers with any degree of certainty. Some will stand with her because, like us, they believe in her. Some will stand with her because they have seen how badly Shadea Aru has dealt with her power. But most will take no stand at all.
That works both ways, of course, Kermadec pointed out. They do not choose to stand with her, but will not stand with Shadea either. That gives us a chance.
Why do you support her? Rue asked Belizen, glancing at Trefin Maurice as well. Why have you taken her side?
Belizen blushed.
It's not easy to explain. I do so in part because she was kind to me when others were not. She brought me to Paranor at the suggestion of another druid, from a village in the Rune where my talents were considered abnormal and my safety threatened. I do not know how she found out about me, but she told me that I belonged with her. I believed that. She has never given me cause to think badly of her, or to want her gone. I think she is the Ard Ris we need. I think she understands the purposes of magic better than anyone.
I came from a village close to Belizen's, Trefin Maurice added. We did not know each other before Paranor, but have become friends since. I came to Paranor on my own, seeking a chance to study with the druids. My mistress gave me that chance. She gave me responsibilities and taught me herself on more than one occasion.
She is a great lady,
Belizen bit her lip, glancing quickly at her companion.
Those who follow her are mostly younger and never knew her as the Ill's Witch. The others, the older ones, cannot seem to forget. They think of her still as a dark creature, capable of reverting without warning. They do not know her as Trefin and I do. They are less forgiving because their lives are too deeply rooted in the past.
They are not alone, Beck said quietly. Perhaps that is just the way of things. He surveyed the faces of the others. Very well. We know what we have to do. We have to find a way into the keep and the sleeping chamber of the Ard Ris. That is where Penderyn and Grianne will reappear when they return from the Forbidding. He almost added, if they can find a way back. But he caught himself just in time. Rue didn't need to hear him saying anything about the odds. She understood them well enough. It is more complicated than that, Trefin Maurice interjected quickly. We have to find a way to be inside the sleeping chamber at just the right time. We have to devise a way of knowing exactly when Pen and my mistress will reappear. If we don't choose the right moment, Shadea and her allies will find us out. The little company went silent, dismayed at the prospect of being stopped after they had come so far and endured so much. But the task the young druid had just described seemed impossible. Beck turned to Tagwin.
The King of the Silver River said that the keys to helping Pen were in the hands of his companions, Kermadec, Kyber Lesedil, and yourself. Maybe we should start there. Can you think what he might have been talking about? Is there some special kind of help that you can give us?
Tagwin considered the question.
Well, there is one possibility, he said after a moment. I know a way into Paranor using tunnels that run beneath the bluff to the furnace room and continue all through the walls of the keep. The Ard Ris showed them to me once, a maze of passages. She used magic to block those leading to her rooms. But perhaps your own magic can undo hers.
So we can reach the sleeping chamber unseen if I can remove my sister's safeguards? Beck asked.
The dwarf nodded rather reluctantly.
Perhaps. If Shadea hasn't discovered the tunnels as well and set traps of her own.
We'll have to risk it, Beck declared at once. We've risked worse already to get where we are. Kermadec, what of you?
The rock troll knotted his great hands and looked at Atalan.
Brother, I think the trolls need to show the four lands where we stand in this business. Marching against the Ordos is a waste of time and purpose. We need to march on Paranor and the druids instead. They attacked Taupo Ruff and drove our people out. The attack was unprovoked. Dismissing the troll guard while it was still in service to the Ard Ris is insult enough, although we could have endured it. But attacking our home is beyond acceptable. Perhaps we should repay their visit with one of our own.
Atalan's response was a slow, wicked grin.
Let's pull down the walls around their ears. Or at least pull the wool over their eyes, a distraction to give you time to get into place.
Kermadec glanced at the others.
Several thousand rock trolls gathered at the gates will be something that not even the druids can ignore. If we must, we will come through those gates to your aid, but at the very least, we will keep those snakes pinned down within their own fortress for the time it takes for our mistress to deal with them as she chooses.
And deal with them she will, you may be sure,
Tagwin grunted, looking almost happy.
That leaves Kyber Elesidil, Bellazin said. What of her?
Her purpose seems easier to divine, Beck responded quickly. She carries the elf stones given her by Arryn Elesidil. They are seeking stones, and I think finding the demon that has crossed over from the Forbidding will be our first order of business after my sister returns. The elf stones will make that task much easier.
He looked from face to face in the darkness. We have at least the beginnings of a plan. I think that is the best we can hope for.
What I don't understand, Rue declared suddenly, is why the King of the Silver River didn't make this business of the keys and the companions clearer to you in your dream, Beck. He could have told you what purpose Kermadec and Tagwin and Kyber Elesidil were to serve. Why didn't he do that?
Fairy creatures and shades are secretive and seldom speak the whole truth, Bellazin ventured.
But Beck shook his head. I think it is something else. I think we were given a starting point, but nothing more. The future remains undecided. Things may change as events unfold, and we must be ready to change with them. If the King of the Silver River had told me in my dream exactly what the keys were, we might have become too reliant on his words. As it is, we remain uncertain that we have it right. He wants that. He wants us to find our own way. He wants us to understand that the way is not yet determined. There was a long silence as the others contemplated his words. They knew where they must go and what they must do, but they still did not know how they would accomplish it. The future was a mystery. It was the way the world had always worked. It was the way it would work here.
We must leave at once, Tagwin declared. We have no idea how much time remains before the Ardreese and young Pendaren cross back.
But Beck shook his head. No, Tagwin. We need to rest first. We'll stay where we are until dawn, sleep while we can, and fly north tomorrow to Kermadec's people. Once the trolls are safely delivered and can begin their preparations for a march on Paranor, the rest of us will go ahead to search for Kyber Elesidil.
And to discover when my mistress and your son will reappear within the keep, Belezin added quietly. It was a disturbing reminder of how difficult the days ahead were going to be. One by one, the members of the company rose and went off to sleep. Most had not slept in days and were exhausted. Beck was the exception. Better rested than the others, he went back up into the pilot box to keep watch. He was surprised when he found that Rue was following him.
You should go to sleep, he said, turning back to stop her, reaching out to touch her cheek. You've slept less than anyone.
She nodded. I'll sleep soon enough. But I have to say something to you first. Whatever else happens, Beck, I intend to make certain that once Pendaren gets free of the forbidding, he is kept safe. I intend to protect him from Shadea Aru and the rest of those monsters. I don't care what it takes. I don't even care what happens to me. She was almost in tears as she finished. He tried to hold her, but she pushed him away, refusing to be comforted, defiance on her features. Promise me that you will do the same.
You know you don't have to ask me this, he said. You know I feel the same way you do.
Tight-lipped, she nodded. I do know it. But I also know that your sister is involved, and that her interests may conflict with ours. Her plans for Penn may not be acceptable, so I need to hear you say it, just in case that happens. I need to hear you promise that if a choice is necessary, you will choose our son. A sadness inside left him hollow and sick at heart. He knew he would never be able to resolve his wife's feelings, her mistrust and her suspicions for his sister. He understood why, and he did not blame her. Had he been in her shoes, he would have felt the same. He reached for her hands, and this time she did not back away.
I promise, he said. Nothing bad will happen to Penn. No chances will be taken with his safety. His needs come before those of Grian and the Druid Order.
She came into his arms then, reaching to hold him close, her cheek placed against his, her mouth so close to his ear that he could hear her breathing. I'm sorry I had to ask that, she whispered.
Don't be. Don't be sorry for anything.
I wish Big Red were here.
I wish Quentin were here.
But her brother was somewhere off the coast of the Blue Divide, flying his airship in service to whoever had paid him most recently, and Quentin Lea was dead 2 years, never fully recovered from the wounds he had received in Parcasia. Beck thought often of them both, and thinking of them made him wish he could turn time back far enough
for them all to be together just once more. But life didn't give you second chances at such things. Life just swept you along and never took you back to where you had been. "It will be all right," he whispered. He had said that to her once before, and had not been certain it was true. This time, for reasons he could not explain, he felt that it might be.
Chapter 15. When he was finished speaking, Shadea Aru studied Paisen Wentz as if studying an interesting insect, glanced momentarily at Trant Rowan, and then turned her back to both of them and looked out the window into the fading afternoon light.
"Tell it to me again," she said softly. She managed to keep the rage from her voice, but it radiated from her body like heat off sun-baked earth in midsummer. She sensed their trepidation, their uncertainty, but she let them live with it as the silence between them lengthened.
"I really don't see the point in going over it a second time," Paisen Wentz replied.
She could picture his exchange of looks with Trant Rowan, could picture as well the sullen, gimlet-eyed stare, the one that waffled between boredom and disdain he was giving her back. She could picture the way his sharp gnome features were tightening, eyes narrowing and mouth twisting into a crooked line. She had seen that look often enough to have it memorized. She knew when to expect it, even thinking of it enraged her further.
"I just want to be sure I didn't miss anything," she said.
She remained, turned away, so that they couldn't see her face. The silence returned and lengthened slowly as she waited to see which of them would speak next. Until then, Paisen had done all the talking. That was unusual, given the fact that it was Trant Rowan who normally did the talking for them both. He was the one who stayed calm when there was bad news to deliver or an untenable position to defend. He was the steady one. Paisen was the weasel, the sly one, the manipulator, and perhaps they had decided that his skills were what would work best in their current predicament. If they had possessed an ounce of sense between them, they would have realized that nothing would save them. Paisen cleared his throat.
"There is nothing to be gained from going over it all.
Tell it to me again,"
she screamed, wheeling now to fix him with her white-hot glare. Her tall, muscular body was taut and flexed, as if she might attack him. He blanched at her words, at her posture. He wilted under her glare. He turned small and insignificant, but he was quick-witted and adaptable, and he could return to form in a moment's time, so she gave him no hint of compassion, no suggestion that his lifeline would extend beyond the next moment.
"Cat got your tongue, Paisen?" she spit, taking a quick step toward him, causing him to take several back. "Is the task too difficult for you? Is repeating the words you just spoke too onerous, too demanding?"
"I want to hear them again, Paisen. I want to hear you tell it all to me again. Now."
"Let him be," Trant Rowan said, speaking for the first time.
She shifted her angry gaze instantly.
"Oh, so you would speak in his place then?"
"Do so, Trant Rowan. Amuse me."
"No one is amused, Shadea. Your sarcasm is wasted. We are as angry as you are about what has happened. But it isn't anything we could have avoided. We thought the boy safely locked away."
"Yes, I'm sure you did," she snapped. "Very much the way you thought his parents were safely locked away. But they escaped as well, didn't they? In fact, they escaped first. Odd. You were given some indication that your security was not all that tight, but that doesn't seem to have made any difference because you didn't change anything, and so the boy escaped too."
Trant Rowan shook his head.
"The parents escaped because two of our number,
misguided believers in the right of Grian Ormsford to be considered Ard Rhys, even past all reasonable hope, helped them escape. Young druids, Treffen Morris, whom we mistrusted already, and a girl about whom I know almost nothing. If not for them, the boy's parents would still be here, locked away. But we will get them back again. She laughed at him. You sent out word that you have their son, thinking that they will march right back to Paranor when they hear the news. You are deluded. They know what will happen if they return, even to save their son, whom we don't, in fact, have anyway. You underestimated them once, and you are doing so again. Besides, it makes no difference now whether we have them or not, does it? She stalked across the room to where the door to her sleeping chamber stood closed, flung it open, and knocked the gnome guard who crouched with his ear to the door all the way across the hall and into the wall beyond, where he lay stunned and bleeding. Try to listen to my conversations again, and I will cut your throat, she hissed, speaking to him in his own tongue, her voice thick and guttural in the gnome way. No one is to come near this door again until I open it. Without waiting for a response, she slammed the door shut, wheeling back on the other two. They listen to everything, your trusted followers, Pison. They listen and report to you, but that's going to stop right now. Terror flickered in Pison Wentz's yellow eyes. She watched it shift into a hint of desperation and shook her head in disgust. You are hopeless. She glanced disdainfully at Trant Rowan. Both of you. She stalked across the room to the window and stared out into the coming night. She wished it would close around the keep and swallow up everyone in it who had failed her. She wished it would swallow those traitors who had helped the Ormsfords escape. She wished it would swallow up those fools who had taken sides against her in the matter, starting with Sen Dunsadan and Iridia Illyri. She wheeled back around. The parents escaped because you weren't smart enough to expect them to try, she snapped at Trant Rowan. The boy escaped because you weren't smart enough to learn from the example of the parents. You took away the staff. You locked him in a cell, and you thought that was the end of it. Wait for Shadea to return, you thought. That was all that was necessary.
I thought it sufficient, yes, Trant Rowan replied tightly.
She gave him a withering glare. It never occurred to you, I don't suppose, that you were bringing the boy to the one place he should never have been brought. He frowned.
What do you mean?
She stared at him without speaking, the weight of her gaze enough to crush another man. You don't understand anything, do you? Neither of you understands what's happened. Pison Wentz exhaled sharply.
We understand, Shadea. They've escaped, all of them. If you want to blame us, then do so. But we will get them back again.
Will you? She whispered. She walked over to a writing desk and sat behind it, thinking that it might be time to put an end to them both. Why wait? With Tarek Molt dead, and Iridia turned traitor and perhaps something worse, these two were the last of those who had conspired with her to eliminate Grian Ormsford. Her grip on the Third Druid Order was strong enough now that she could afford to do away with them. She considered the idea a moment longer before dismissing it. It was still too soon. You took a staff from the boy, she said to Trant Rowan. It had rune markings carved up and down its length. The boy tried to hide it from you, but you knew it was a talisman. She paused. Do you know what it does? The tall man shook his head.
No.
You took it away from him, and you put it in this room?
I used magic to suspend it in a cradle so that it would wait undisturbed for your return.
Except that the boy, or this elven girl who helped him escape, found a way to undo your magic. So now the staff is gone as well as the boy. He stared at her wordlessly. Where, Trant Rowan? Where do you think they went? He shook his head.
He was trapped in this room with the girl when we found them. The girl has the use of druid magic, rudimentary but effective. She held us off long enough for him to find another way out. Perhaps out one of the windows, or maybe into a secret passageway, like the one you used to get access to Grian Ormsford while she slept.
But you searched?
Everywhere.
She rose from the desk and came out to stand in front of him.
Think back.
That boy has been on a mission from the beginning. He has been searching for something that will help him find his missing aunt, his beloved aunt. Tagwyn went with him. Then Aaron Elessadil and Kermadec, they all went with him. That suggests they believed in him. What is it that they thought this boy could do? I'll tell you what. They thought he could find a way to get inside the Forbidding.
That's ridiculous, Pison went snapped. They didn't think so, she snapped back.
Aaron Elessadil gave his life to help that boy. We might assume that he had a good reason for doing so. We might even assume he thought the boy's life more important than his own. Why would he think that? Because the boy was the best hope any of them had of reaching Grian Ormsford inside the Forbidding. That being so, the one thing we didn't want to do was bring him anywhere near the place where she went in.
Especially after you caught him trying to hide a talisman of unknown origin and power.
She paused, looking from face to face. But that was exactly what you did. Now both are gone. The boy and his staff vanished into thin air in this very room. She took a deep breath. Take a moment and think it through carefully. Where do you think they are?
Trant Rowan's face had gone white. That isn't possible, he whispered.
No one can get into the Forbidding.
She gave him a tight smile. We did. He stared at her, unable to put words to what he was thinking. There is one way to find out if I'm right, she said softly. You do still have the elven girl locked away, don't you? She hasn't escaped with the others, has she?
Trant Rowan flushed.
We have her.
Bring her to me.
He left at once, taking Pison Wentz with him, eyes straight ahead as they stalked through the doorway. Neither of them glanced at her on their way out.
Good, she thought. Let them think about what they have done. Let them dwell on it a little, and consider what might be in store for them if I am right.
She stood alone in her chambers and despaired over how convoluted things had become. Their plan had been a simple one in the beginning. Confine Grian Ormsford to the Forbidding and take control of the Druid Order. Sen Dunsadan had given them the Liquid Night, and she had found a way to use it. The plan had worked exactly as it was supposed to work, but since then the situation had spiraled steadily out of control. It had begun with that boy, Penderyn Ormsford. Why it had begun with him rather than with his more experienced and more deeply talented father, she still didn't know. Nor did she know, even now, exactly what it was that he had set out to do, even though she was pretty sure that he had found a way to do it. If this elven girl confirmed her suspicions about where he was, she would have to take new measures to protect herself. She had come too far and suffered too much to think of giving up what she had gained. The rest of them could do as they wished, if she let them live long enough. But she had set her mind on her own course of action and did not intend to deviate from it. Grian Ormsford was powerful, but she was also mortal. By now, she could be dead. By now, she should be. But a nagging certainty whispered that she wasn't. Better I die than that I concede anything to her, or to that boy. She imagined momentarily what she would do to Penderyn Ormsford if she somehow managed to get her hands on him.
the image that came to mind made her shiver. When Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz reappeared with the elven girl, Shadea was surprised to see how small and vulnerable-looking she was. She had imagined the girl larger and more imposing. The gnome hunter clothing she wore, obviously stolen to provide her with a disguise, was ill-fitting, loose, and made her look smaller still. But when she saw Shadea, she displayed a look of such obvious defiance that it instantly infuriated the sorceress.
Little fool!
She walked up to the girl without a word, snatched her by her clothing so that she was off balance, and struck her hard across the face. The blow was delivered, open-handed, so as not to break anything, but the sound of it caused Trant Rowan to flinch. The force of the slap sent the girl sprawling. Without waiting for her to recover, Shadea stalked over to where she lay, grabbed another handful of clothing, and hauled her back to her feet. Then, she placed her face inches from the girl's. "That was to give you some small idea of how I feel about what you have done. It should also indicate what sort of trouble you are in." The defiance was gone from the girl's face, replaced by a sullen acceptance of her fate. Shadea gave her a moment to recover, to let the words sink in, then struck her again, knocking her to the floor once more. This time, when she stood the girl up again, there were tears in her eyes.
"It hurt more this time, didn't it?" Shadea asked softly. "But I haven't begun to hurt you yet." "What is your name?"
When the girl didn't answer fast enough, Shadea struck her again, twice, the open-handed blows delivered first to one side of her face, and then to the other. The girl's head snapped back and forth with the blows, and she gasped audibly with each one. Shadea gripped her clothing with her free hand so that she couldn't fall, kept her standing upright, sagging slightly from the attack.
"Your name, girl," she repeated. "You are an Elessadil or you are a thief, because only one or the other would possess the elf stones. Which is it?"
"Kyber Elessadil," the girl whispered.
Her face was already beginning to redden and swell. Shadea glanced at her companions, both of whom shook their heads, neither recognizing anything beyond the Elessadil part of the name.
"What are you to Kellen Elessadil?" Shadea snapped.
"He is my brother."
"Was,"
Shadea corrected.
"He's dead. Killed on the Preken Doran almost a week ago."
She watched the girl's gaze lift to meet hers, and saw more tears fill her eyes. Good. She was already beginning to come apart. This wouldn't be so hard.
"You are all alone, Kyber Elessadil," she whispered, her voice flat and emotionless. "No one even knows you are here, save those you left stranded in the ruins of Stridegate, and the boy you helped escape."
"I wouldn't expect any help from them if I were you, nor from any other source. You no longer possess the elf stones. I have them safely tucked away. You have no real druid magic to help you escape. You are a neophyte. Your fate is sealed. If you want to live, you will tell me exactly what I want to know. Are you listening to me?"
The girl nodded, but there was a hint of defiance still in her dark eyes. Shadea smiled, foolish bravado. She reached inside the girl's clothing, found a place where the flesh was soft and vulnerable, fastened her fingers like a vice, and twisted. The girl screamed with pain, her body jerking in an effort to get free. Shadea held her fast and twisted harder.
"Are you listening carefully?" she hissed.
The girl nodded, her eyes shut against the pain.
"Then be quick to answer when I ask you a question."
She withdrew her hand.
"I can cause you a great deal more pain than a few slaps across the face and a little twisting of your tender parts. I can hurt you in places you haven't even begun to think about. I can make you beg for me to kill you.
I learned how while I served with the Federation Army on the Precandoran. I learned that. And a good deal more that you don't want to know anything about.
She paused. Let's try it again. I ask you a question, you give me an answer. Where did Pendera and Ormsford go? The girl exhaled sharply, her head sagging.
Into the forbidding after the Ard Rhys.
Shadea glanced disdainfully at Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz.
Hear that?
Her eyes challenged them to say otherwise. How did he get into the forbidding? No one can get there without magic. Was it the staff he carried out of Stridegate that let him do so? The girl nodded again and swallowed thickly.
How did he find this staff?
She was furious at the idea of it, enraged that such a talisman even existed. How did he know what it would do? She reached down and yanked the girl's chin off her chest, pinching her jaws.
Speak to me, you little fool.
The dark eyes opened, filled with hate.
The King of the Silver River told him.
Shadea stared at her wordlessly, then let her head drop down again.
A fairy creature was aiding the boy. No wonder he had found a way.
She refused to look at her druid allies, afraid of what she would see in their eyes after hearing that. She snatched a handful of the girl's close-cropped hair and pulled her head back up again.
Why this boy?
She demanded. Why him? Why not his father? His father is Beck Ormsford, brother to Grianne. He is the one with real magic. What does this boy have that brought the King of the Silver River to him? The girl shook her head slowly.
I don't know. Something different, something...
If he succeeds,
if he finds Grianne Ormsford, what happens then? How does he get back?
The staff.
The staff.
The staff what?
What does it do?
She shook the girl until she could hear her bones crack.
What does the staff do, little elven girl? How does it work?
The girl shuddered.
Brings them back, together, to the place they went in.
She sagged heavily, and Shadea realized she had fainted, too much pain apparently. She wasn't as strong as she had tried to make herself appear. She looked frail, and she was, a poor ally to the boy. But then they were all poor allies, those who had sought to help him, the living and the dead. He had wasted himself relying on them. Whatever chance he had, it did not lie with the likes of this girl and Tagwin and Kermadec and his rock trolls. She flung the girl to the floor and let her lie. Her mind raced. It didn't matter if the boy had crossed over into the forbidding. It didn't matter if he had found a temporary ally in a spirit creature. What mattered was that his chances of surviving inside the forbidding were much less than those of Grianne Ormsford, and hers were poor. What mattered was that if he somehow got out of the forbidding, she must reduce those chances to zero. She exhaled sharply, her focus on what was needed sharp and clear. She understood the situation perfectly. If Grianne Ormsford and the boy must return the same way they went in, then they must come back through the very chamber in which she now stood. That gave her a distinct advantage, and she intended to make use of it. She turned toward her allies. If either had been startled by what they had heard, they had managed to recover their composure. Pison Wentz wore his sly, cautious look. Trant Rowan was steady-eyed and stone-faced against whatever she had to offer. She surprised them.
What's done is done,
she said quietly.
It was as much my fault as it was yours. I am the one who leads. I am the one who must bear responsibility for any failure. I should have taken better precautions before going south to Arishag. I regret that. But there is nothing to be gained by dwelling on it. Let us consider instead what we must do to compensate.
she moved over to the window and beckoned for them to join her. They did so with a certain degree of hesitation. Neither was convinced that she had undergone a real change of heart.
The boy is inside the forbidding, searching for his aunt. He might find her. If both can manage to stay alive long enough, he might even manage to bring her back again through the wall of the forbidding, using whatever magic it is that this staff gives him. I don't think it is likely or even possible, but I don't want to chance being wrong.
She spoke in a whisper, so that they were forced to bend close. She spoke as if she were in fear of being overheard. In truth, she simply wanted them to think she was taking them into her confidence, which, in a way, she was. She just wasn't doing so for the reasons they thought.
We know that the staff's magic will bring them to these chambers. They must be waiting for them if that happens. More to the point, we must find a way to make certain that they will be rendered helpless. Even if we are not here personally to intercept them, we must make certain that it doesn't matter, that they are caged and stripped of their power and made prisoners. They must be given no chance to use their magic, especially Grianne Ormsford. They must be disarmed.
You make it sound so easy, Shadea, Pison Wendt sneered, as if disarming a druid of Grianne Ormsford's power were easily within our means, but it isn't, is it? Catching her off guard and vulnerable was our best chance. She won't be caught napping a second time. She will come back through that doorway like a whirlwind, and we will all be swept away.
Shadea gave him a pitying smile. Such dramatics, Pison. You would think she frightened you.
Are you frightened of her?
We both have a healthy respect for what she will likely do to us if she gets the chance, Trant Rowan answered for him, as should you.
She gave him a quick shake of her head.
I don't respect anyone who misuses power as she has. I don't respect anyone with her history. She is an animal, and I will see her caged or put down.
Brave words, Shadea. He looked less than convinced. How do you intend to give them weight?
She shrugged.
We'll create a triagonal, she said.
For the first time that afternoon, she saw agreement reflected in their eyes.
First, she declared, when they had finished discussing how the triagonal would be achieved, we have to dispose of the girl. She's told us what we want to know about the boy. She has no further use. Sooner or later, someone will come looking for her, and I don't want them to find her here.
Pison Wentz shrugged.
What do you want done with her?
Have your gnome hunters take her down to the furnaces and throw her in.
She glanced at the girl, who still lay unconscious on the floor.
She won't be much trouble, but bind her anyway. Here, take these and throw them in as well.
She handed the pouch with the elf stones to Trant Rowan. He stared at them in disbelief.
But Shadea...
They're useless to us, she interrupted quickly. Only elves can make use of their magic. We're not elves. If we can't make use of them, let's see to it that no one else can either. Besides, they are markers. If anyone finds them on us or at Paranor, they will have found a link to the girl. We don't want that. No, throw them into the furnace and be done with it.
Come back here when it is finished, and we will begin building the triagonal.
When they were gone, taking the girl and the elf stones with them, she slipped from the room and went down through the corridor and stairwells of the keep to a small guard room that sat near the back of the north wall.
A triagonal is strong enough to hold even Grianne Ormsford,
she was thinking, as she moved along the passageways. Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz recognized this, and so were willing to offer their talents to form it. Three magics, from three separate sources, combined in the right way, created a net that would contain and neutralize even the most powerful magic wielder. It took time and effort to build a triagonal,
but she had never heard of anyone who was able to overcome one once caught in it. Stringing it about the perimeters of the room would assure them of snaring anyone who entered. There was no escaping a triagonal once caught in it. Only its creators could undo it. Grianne Ormsford and the boy would be snared like rabbits, or more like wolves, but snared nevertheless. By the time the triagonal was released, their lives would be over. She considered the possibility that the triagonal would disintegrate before they were ready to attempt their return. It enjoyed only a limited lifetime, only a finite period of existence, because the magic was so powerful that eventually it became unstable and collapsed. But another could be built, and another after that, should the need arise. At some point, it would be clear that her victims weren't coming back after all, and the effort to create further triagonals could be abandoned. She was satisfied that her plan would work. She was confident that she could undo the damage that her inept allies had created. She reached a heavy wooden door at the end of the darkened passageway set in the recesses of the northeast tower. She rapped sharply on it, and heard a murmur of voices and a furtive scuffling from the room beyond. Then, the lock released, and a bearded face thrust into view, eyes that were mean and piggish fixed on her, then looked away quickly. The man's head disappeared back inside the chamber.
"Gresherin!"
he hissed. She waited until a second man appeared, this one big and hulking, but with a sharper, more cunning look to him. He bowed to her immediately and stepped outside the room and into the hallway, closing the door behind him.
"Mistress," he greeted, "you have need of me."
She took him away from the door and into the shadows.
"I have a job for you. I want you to select 4 of your best men to dispose of someone. They will have the advantage of numbers and surprise, but that is likely all. They must strike quickly and surely. There will be no second chance. If they succeed and return alive, I will give them a year's pay for their efforts."
"Fair enough, mistress,"
he rumbled.
"More than fair. Who is it that you want killed?"
"A traitor, Gresherin," she told him. "A druid traitor."
Chapter 16. When Trant Rowan threw her over his shoulders and carried her from the room, Kyber Alessadil was not unconscious. She was pretending to be, as she had pretended to be for most of the time after Shadea had thrown her down. But she was awake. It was a trick of elemental magic she had learned from Aaron. If she was suffering too much pain, whatever the reason, she could distance herself from her anguish. She could quite literally go outside her body. She could disconnect her emotional self from her physical self. She couldn't do it for long, only a couple of minutes at a time. When the ruse worked, it gave her the appearance of being unconscious or asleep. In the past, the attempt was sometimes unsuccessful because her concentration failed. She had good reason not to let it fail here. The pain Shadea was inflicting on her was excruciating. Once she appeared unconscious and Shadea lost interest in her, she slipped back inside her pain-racked body, hoping the druids were preoccupied enough that they would let her be. She listened to what they had to say, though. She listened carefully. Some of it was inaudible to her, the words whispered too softly and from too far away to be heard clearly. But she heard enough to get the gist of what they were deciding, especially when it came to the part about disposing of her. All she could think about after that was, "They're going to kill me." She had to do something to save herself, anything, but she had no idea what that might be. She was without weapons, including the elf stones, and weak with pain and fear. The ordeal at Shadea's hands, while not breaking her, had left parts of her physically and emotionally drained. She had thought herself tougher than she was. Shadea had been right about that. It was a sobering experience to discover how badly mistaken she had been. She lay limp over Trant Rowan's shoulder, her eyes closed, but her mind racing.
She heard the tall druid's breathing as he carried her. She heard the sound of Pison Wentz walking next to them, his gait just different enough from his companions to be distinctive. There were only the two of them. It was probably the best numerical odds she could get, but she knew that favorable odds alone weren't going to be enough to save her. At that point, she didn't know what was going to be enough, and she was trying hard not to panic. She had been confined to a cell in the depths of the keep since they had broken into the chambers of the Ard Ris 2 days earlier and overpowered her. Pendaren was gone into the Forbidding by then, swept away by the magic of the Dark Wand, and when they discovered she was alone, they tried to make her tell them where he was. She had feigned ignorance, as if his disappearance were as confusing to her as it was to them. She had suggested every false possibility she could think of, and they had seemed all too willing to accept that somewhere in the web of her deceptive explanations they would find the truth. They had not tortured her or mistreated her in any way to discover if she lied, which had surprised her. She had come to understand why. They had saved her for Shadea Aru. They had saved her for someone who understood how to employ torture in the most effective way. Still racked with pain, still humiliated by her collapse, she knew that she would have told the sorceress anything. In fact, she had told her more than enough. Shadea was now aware that Pen was inside the Forbidding, searching for the Ard Ris. She knew that if the boy found his aunt, they would return with the aid of the Dark Wand to the chamber of the Ard Ris. Shadea would be waiting for them. The damage to the chamber entry in the battle of 2 days earlier had been repaired. It would be an easy matter to seal off the room. Once that was done, Shadea could implement a triagonal. Even an apprentice druid like Kyber understood what a triagonal was. Every practitioner of magic in the Four Lands aspired to a level of excellence that would allow his or her participation in the creation of such a wonder. Triagonals were the most difficult form of magic to employ because they required the talents of not one, but three practitioners of equally advanced abilities. Druids were the only ones she had ever heard of who even thought about trying to create triagonals. Even then, under current druid law, it could not be done without the authorization and supervision of the Ard Ris. Few attempts at a triagonal had been made in her lifetime, and she did not know the details of any of them. Most such attempts were little more than forms of practice to give credence to the belief that a druid had advanced far enough in his or her studies to combine talents with others with similar aspirations. A successful attempt was proof of mastery of a certain level of magic. There was little doubt in Kyber's mind that Shadea and the other two were sufficiently talented to create a triagonal that could imprison, if not completely incapacitate, even as gifted a magic wielder as Grianne Ormsford. A combination of three strong magics was just too much for one, even if the one was immensely powerful. If Grianne and Pen returned through the Forbidding after the triagonal had been set in place, they would be caught in a deadly trap. And she was the only one who could prevent it. Aside from the three who would create the triagonal, she was the only one who knew about it. If she died in the furnace, as they intended, the chances of the Ard Ris and Pen making a successful return were narrowed to almost nothing. She had been carried down several levels by them, the druids taking the back stairs to avoid being seen, keeping to the little used parts of the keep. She hung limply over Trant Rowan's broad shoulder, still pretending at unconsciousness, trying to devise a plan. The idea of challenging two powerful druids at the same time was not a consideration. She had to wait until they had delivered her to the gnome hunters before she could act. She did not have to wait long. They quickly reached the ground level of the keep and took her into a room filled with racks of weapons and armor. She risked a quick look around and caught glimpses of heavy wooden benches scarred by blades and fire, boxes of cutting tools, and grinding machines clamped in place.
Bits and pieces of metal lay scattered across the worn surfaces of the benches and stone floor, and the air smelled of oil and was thick with dust. Trant Rowan slid her off his shoulder and onto the floor and left her in a heap. She lay without moving, eyes closed.
"Wait here,"
Pison Went said to him, and went out again. Kyber waited until she heard the door close, then waited some more in the ensuing silence. She felt Trant Rowan's eyes on her, as if he was waiting for her to move, to reveal her subterfuge to him. She forced herself to remain exactly as he had left her, limp and unmoving, eyes closed. She let her breathing slow, and she listened for his movements. When, moments later, she heard him turn away from her, she risked a quick look. He was perusing the room, studying the racks of weapons and armor. She shifted her gaze just enough that she could glimpse the floor about her. She searched for a weapon she could use to protect herself, but there were no weapons to be found, nothing but scraps of metal, leavings from the workbenches. Trant Rowan moved away a few steps, his hand reaching out to feel the flat of a broadsword. Her eyes skipped across the littered surface of the floor, scanning desperately through the debris. There were blades everywhere, all of them out of reach. Then she caught sight of something that might prove useful. She eased an outflung arm carefully toward a rough piece of metal, its edge razor sharp. She pulled the scrap into the palm of her hand and closed her fingers around it carefully. It was not much of a weapon, but it would have to do. Trant Rowan glanced back at her suddenly, but she had her eyes closed again and her body limp. He studied her nevertheless, as if noticing that her position had changed. She held her breath, waiting. Then the door opened, and Pison Wentz reappeared. Four gnome hunters followed him in, then moved over to where she lay, rolled her over, and secured her wrists and ankles with heavy cord. Lying limp and unmoving, she let them do as they wished without signaling that she knew what was happening. Their strong, wiry hands roamed across her body, turning her this way and that, causing a wave of revulsion to run through her. Her instincts screamed at her to fight back, to break free while she still had the chance, before she was trussed so tightly she could not. But she knew that would be a mistake. She clutched the jagged piece of metal in her hand, her only real chance of surviving this, and forced herself to stay quiet. When they were done binding her, they tied a rag about her mouth, covering it so completely that she was forced to begin breathing through her nose. The gnomes stood up, looking back at Pison Wentz. The druid spoke to them softly, then handed one the pouch that contained the elf stones.
"I don't like giving these up," he said to Trant Rowan. "It seems such a waste."
"Getting caught with them would be a death sentence," the other replied. "Shadea is right. Better to be rid of them." He paused. "Can we trust these four to do what is needed and keep silent afterward?"
"They understand their orders." "Then let's be done with it."
Pison Went said something further, and one of the four picked Kyber up off the floor, tossed her over his shoulder as if she were no more than a sack of grain, and followed the other three out the door and into the torchlit hallway beyond.
She knew where they were taking her. She knew what they intended to do with her once they got there.
It was all she could do to keep from screaming. They went deep into the bowels of the keep, along twisting passageways that grew increasingly narrow and steadily darker, down stairways thick with gloom and heavy with damp. Eventually, there were no wall-mounted torches to brighten the way, and the gnomes were forced to light and carry their own. Kyber heard the drip of water and could smell the minerals the water contained.
The gloom was impenetrable after more than a few feet, even with the torchlight to chase it back. In the silence, the only sounds were the labored breathing of the gnomes and the measured beat of their footfalls. If she had been afraid before, she was terrified now. But she fought down her terror, because she knew that if she panicked, she was finished. She could open her eyes without fear of being discovered, and did so. It was too dark for her captors to see her eyes, and she was hanging head down anyway, her face obscured by the cloak of the guard who bore her. She had gained a fresh measure of anonymity. She was little more than a dark lump. She wondered if the men knew who she was. She wondered if they cared. She tried to imagine what it must have taken to imbue them with such blind obedience. Soldiers did what they were told and did not ask questions, she supposed. It was something she understood, but would never accept. She maneuvered the scrap of metal between her fingers until she had a good grip on it and began to saw at her bonds. She did so slowly and carefully, trying her best to disguise her movements by keeping them small and the rest of her body still. It was harder than she had expected, because a certain amount of force was required to make any progress with the cutting. She did not know how long she had to free herself. She felt as if she had no time at all. She wanted to hurry her efforts, to work harder, to throw caution to the winds, to just be free. But Aaron had taught her that haste was your worst enemy when you were threatened, that mistakes were too easily made and chances lost. Patience was what would save you. Every fiber in her body shrieked at her to hurry, to cut faster, but she held herself in check. Be patient. Trussed and helpless on her way to her own death, she wanted to be anything but. Time slipped away, precious and fluid. She could not hold it back. She worked the metal diligently, even though by then her own fingers were cut and bleeding from the effort, and the metal shard dangerously slippery. She almost dropped it several times, and she was forced, more than once, to cease her efforts long enough to wipe clean the shard and her fingers. She smelled her blood, coppery and rank. She could smell her own fear, the sweat of her body. She found that she was crying, and hadn't even been aware of it. She sawed harder, working diligently against the stubborn bonds as her captors trudged on, dark and silent wraiths in the gloom. Burning pitch hissed and spit at the ends of the brands they carried, the flames glinting in the dark like eyes, throwing shadows everywhere. She would be seen, she kept thinking. If she kept this up much longer, she would be caught out. The air was growing warmer. Her eyes snapped up as if to discover the reason, even though she already knew it. They were getting close to the furnace and the fire pits that fed it. The bonds that secured her wrists snapped, nearly falling away before she caught them in her fingers and held them in place. She was free. She flexed her hands, first one, then the other, careful of her movements. Her ankles were still bound, but there was no help for it. She couldn't wait any longer. She had to act now. But what was she going to do? Her eyes skittered everywhere, then stopped. The butt of her captor's long knife protruded from its sheath, less than a foot away from where her head hung down. Momentary panic set in. She had never killed anyone. She had never even had to fight for her life, never been threatened with serious harm until these past few weeks. Aaron had taught her how to defend herself, but she had never tested her skills in a situation even remotely like this one. She was just a girl, really. She was barely grown. But they were going to kill her. She swallowed hard, the panic deepening, threatening to immobilize her. She shouldn't be here. This shouldn't be happening. If she hadn't been so stubborn about going with Aaron and Penn, if she hadn't insisted on the quest being made in the first place, if she hadn't taken the elf stones from where they were kept, hidden away. Her concentration faltered, and the metal shards slipped from her fingers and fell to the passageway floor with an audible ping. She reacted without thinking, snatching the long knife from its sheath and burying it deep in the back of the gnome hunter carrying her. She heard his gasp of dismay and felt his body lurch and then collapse beneath her. She went down with him, rolled clear, and came to rest against one wall, the knife, still in her hands, yanked free of the dead man's body. She caught a glimpse of the other three gnomes as they wheeled back to see what was happening, momentarily confused but already reaching for their weapons. Her legs were still bound and she could not flee them. She was trapped. She dropped the knife instantly and began weaving her hands to summon a protective magic. Please. The magic responded, and the torches flared and went out, leaving the passageway shrouded in darkness. Instantly, she was moving, dragging herself along the wall and away from her captors, the long knife clutched in one hand. The gnome hunters cursed as they stumbled about in the dark, running up against each other and tripping over their dead companion. She rolled all the way across the passage, trying to get as far away from them as she could manage. She had only moments before they found her, whatever she did, and she had to free her legs before that happened. Backed against the far wall, she reached down and began cutting frantically at the bonds that wrapped her ankles. The blade of the knife was sharper and more efficient than the metal shard and severed the ropes in seconds. She was struggling to her feet when the first of them, close enough by that time to hear her movements, thrust his short sword blindly into the rock wall only inches from her head. She reacted instantly, driving her own blade deep into his chest. He roared in pain and fear and staggered away from her, the blade still buried in his body. Weaponless, she backed her way along the wall, hearing the stricken man's grunts and moans mix with the guttural whispers of the two who remained. They would fan out along both walls and come toward her until they found her, but they would be more cautious. She would not get a chance to catch them unawares again. She kept moving away, trying to think what to do. She could flee if she chose, but her instincts told her that, unarmed and unfamiliar with the corridors, it would be impossible to get far in the blackness. The gnomes, more at home in the dark, would hunt her down. She heard them moving toward her already, their boots and clothing soft rustles and scuffs. In the silence. She needed another magic, she thought, but she did not know killing magic, so whatever she tried, it would only buy her a little more time. Perhaps it would gain her another weapon, but could she use it after what had happened? The memory of her blade sinking into the gnomes she had killed was fresh and sharp and made her shudder. She wasn't sure she could do that again. She wasn't sure she should even try. But she must try something. Tell me what I should do, Aaron. He couldn't, of course, not even in her memories of all he had taught her, because nowhere in his instructions had he addressed such a situation. He had been teaching her basic elemental magic right up to the moment they had set out for the Lazarene. True, anticipating the dangers they would face, he had given her harder lessons on the way. But none of them seemed useful against furious gnome hunters stalking her in pitch-black caverns. They were closing on her, the sounds of their approach more distinct. She had no time left. Her back against the passageway wall, she turned toward them, lifted her hands, whispered into the darkness, and used her fingers to guide the magic accordingly, then clapped her hands to her head. Instantly, the passageway was filled with blinding light, its brilliance equal to the intensity of the sun at midday. With her hands, Kyber shielded her eyes against the sudden glare, but the gnomes were caught unprepared and left momentarily blinded. She charged right at them, dodged their groping hands and slashing blades, and broke into the clear to race down the corridor in the direction of the furnace, the explosion of light behind her revealing the way. The gnomes were after her at once, heavy footfalls echoing thunderously, shouts and curses rising up. She ran faster. She had no plan but to get away from them, to reach the confluence of passageways at the furnace and disappear into them. Let them hunt for her then if they wished. She would be much harder to find once they could no longer see her. A wave of heat suddenly washed over her, surging out of the gloom ahead. Pale light flickered from far down at the end of the narrowing passageway, the glow of the pit fires rising into the furnace room. Her goal was in sight. Then, something slammed into her, low on her right side, spinning her around and filling her with a wash of pain and shock. A dagger jutted from the fleshy part of her side. It felt as if a red-hot poker had been jammed into her, but she couldn't afford to take time to stop and pull the dagger free. She ran on instead, fighting down her sudden sense of weakness, hardening her resolve to reach the furnace room. Behind her, the gnome hunters were running to catch up, grunting from the effort, their breathing quick and heavy. She reached the furnace just ahead of them, breaking free of the darkness in a rush that carried her right up against the metal railing of the catwalk that encircled the pit. She caught herself just in time, so close to the fires that she felt her hair singe and her lungs burn. She pushed away hurriedly and began to stagger along the catwalk. The fire pit yawned to one side, a deep, glowing chasm within which the earth's exposed magma burned fiercely, the source of the keep's underground heat. Even with the fires dampened and the vents to the chamber open wide, the heat was all but unbearable. She searched frantically for a way out. Several doors were set in the chamber walls, and across the way a spiral staircase wound upward to another. All were closed. She hurried to the nearest and tried to open it. It refused to budge. Behind her, the gnome hunters stumbled into the chamber and caught sight of her. They hesitated for a moment, then split apart, one circling one way about the catwalk, one circling the other, trapping her between them. She moved quickly to the second door and pulled on the handle. It was locked as well. The heat from the furnace fires and the loss of blood from her wound were making her dizzy. She felt the sticky dampness of blood all down her back. Her strength was fading. She was in danger of passing out. Bracing herself against the chamber wall, she reached back and pulled the dagger free. The pain was excruciating, but she managed to keep from collapsing.